Welcome back to Celluloid Jelly, a podcast featuring a couple of ex-video store guys who just love to talk about movies. I'm CJ Talbot, and joining me as always will be Cesar Alejandro Jr. from Filmsmash.com. Today, we discuss the 2003 supernatural thriller from director Kim Ji-woon, A Tale of Two Sisters.
So this week, guys, we're going to be talking about one of my personal favorite films. That's actually my favorite horror film of all time. The South Korean 2003 horror thriller, A Tale of Two Sisters, directed by Kim Ji-won. Now, like I mentioned earlier, this is my favorite horror film of all time, and I make it a point to watch it yearly. I think I missed last year, but I made up for it. By watching horror films mostly all through October, so this was a welcome revisit after, you know, a non-typical time apart from it.
Sure, and since we're in October, it's time to watch some horror movies and talk about them, so I was thrilled to be able to watch this, knowing that it's your favorite. I thought I had seen this movie, I'm sure that I probably did, but I did not remember it, which was a great thing because of all the twists and turns that it goes through.
Okay, I'm interested to hear your somewhat fresh take on it then.
Well, I don't know how fresh or interesting it's going to be, but I'll certainly do my best for you, good sir.
Okay, but before we get started with that, what have you been watching lately, CJ?
Not as much as I'd like, of course, but yesterday we did go and see The Princess Bride in theaters for 30th anniversary.
Yeah, I saw.
It was a good experience. The theater was packed. It was a good crowd. Lot of laughter. Movie holds up pretty well, and it's just, you know, it's a charming, funny adventure story, the likes of which that we get so rarely. It's not a jaded film. It's not trying to overdo any one particular aspect, whether it be the swashbuckling, you know, piracy or the, you know, just the funny hijinks of Billy Crystal and Carol Kane, I don't think I've ever seen the movie on the big screen, but as you know, at Suncoast where we used to work, that was on the playlist constantly.
Yeah.
So I know that movie incredibly well.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a good chance that, like, I could probably recite 90% of the lines of that film.
Absolutely, but the thing that I was really surprised by was that, like, I didn't know the visuals that well. Because, you know, when you're working, you don't sit there and watch it, but you're listening to it.
Yeah.
So when you work at a video store, like we did for such an incredibly long time, a lot of those films that get rotated.
I saw it most recently about it sometime in 2016, but yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah.
I'll revisit it, but it's always welcome when I do.
Yeah. So, I mean, some of the sets are a little stagey. They shot the whole thing at Shepherd and Studios in London, but for the most part, the sets they look very good. And there's actually some really nice cinematography, especially early in the film with Wesley and Buttercup before he leaves. Some nice sunsets and things like that. So I was pleasantly surprised to kind of just take it in visually and just enjoy the film and see some of the visual humor as opposed to just listening to the dialogue. The one thing that I think really surprised the heck out of me, and like I said, I haven't seen it for a long time, was, do you remember that Princess Bride takes place at Christmas?
No. Is that mentioned in the voiceover?
No. But when the mother walks into Fred Savage's room at the beginning, you see her, I guess she opens the curtains to his room, the windows. And across the street, you can see that the houses are actually decorated with Christmas lights and decorations. And on the back of his bedroom door, there's actually like a Santa Claus thing hanging on the back of the door. And behind the door in the hallway, when Peter Falk walks in, there's like a little Christmas tree. And the Princess Bride book that he brings is actually wrapped in holiday wrapping paper.
So, I don't remember that.
Yeah, I didn't either. So but that's so you can add Princess Bride to your list of Christmas movies that aren't Christmas movies, like Die Hard. For all you people out there that argue that Die Hard is a Christmas movie, you're fucking wrong. But you can add Princess Bride to that too.
Oh man, I think that's a discussion we should table.
For 2 months from now?
Another time.
Because I'll go off, man. When people tell me Die Hard's a Christmas movie, oh god.
Yeah, I'm aware.
I don't give a shit that it takes place at Christmas. It's not a Christmas movie.
Okay, come on, man. Chill out. Let's talk more about The Princess Bride.
Well, I'm pretty much done about that. I mean, it was a delightful experience. I really enjoyed the film. I wouldn't consider it one of my favorite movies of all time, but it's certainly, you know, it's certainly a treat to catch it once in a while.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I always really enjoy it. And, you know, I haven't had an opportunity to watch it in a big screen theatrically. So, you know, if an opportunity arises, I'm definitely going to try to take advantage of that.
I think you have one more chance. The Turner Classic Movies sponsored the event, so they had like a little intro with director Rob Reiner and Ben Mankiewicz, mm-hmm. and then they had a couple of questions after the movie as well, so they kind of bookend it. And I think they're also playing two shows in select theaters on the 18th of this month. So,
okay.
So for you, I don't know. I don't even know what day it is today. But by the time this podcast actually gets out to our fans, that the 18th will have passed. So for them, that's not going to do them any good. But for you, if you have the chance to see it and you want to, there you go.
Today's the 16th, I think.
Yeah, today's the 16th.
All right. We'll see.
Yeah. So, but that was really good. And then, you know, of course, I watched A Tale of Two Sisters to prepare for today. So I'm super excited to hear. I know you're really passionate about the film, and I'm excited to share my thoughts with you. But is there anything else that you watched, you know, recently over the weekend or something that you want to highlight and recommend to our listeners?
Well, you know, I didn't really watch as much, because, the time between our Blade Runner recording and this recording was actually typically much shorter than it usually is.
Yeah. Well, that's because we had to push Blade Runner off a few days, but...
Yeah, I mean, I watched Adam Green's Hatchet for the very first time.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, I've never seen that, actually.
It's pretty damn fun. Like, I totally didn't expect it. It's a slasher. You got, I guess, Kane Hodder, who most people know from his number of appearances as Jason Voorhees in a Friday the 13th film series.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? You got Joel David Moore as the main character. The female lead is Tamara Feldman. And, you know, a stable of, like, other actors in it. Like, I guess Tony Todd has a cameo. Robert Englund's got a cameo.
Wow. Tony Todd, Robert Englund, Kane Hodder. It's like all-stars.
Yeah, Tony Todd plays like a voodoo man or something.
Nice.
So the movie itself... you know, it's nothing really special, but, you know, there's a lot of energy to it. It's got a good sense of humor. And a lot of ultraviolence. So I think, like, if you like something like, say, like Tucker Dale vs. Evil, which I really like.
You know what's really funny? I was just going to say this because I know you're a big fan of Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. I had never seen that film, and the girlfriend made me watch it the other night, too.
I convinced her to watch it years ago.
So I did finally watch it, and it was enjoyable. The big slam on it, I guess, that I would make is that none of the college kid characters really register at all. So it's got like 11 characters, you know, in the movie, and although the college kids sort of like get picked off one by one, none of them really seem to matter except for the one girl. And then, of course, the one guy at the end, but, like...
It's part of it.
Though. Yeah, so. they seem incredibly disposable. But Tucker and Dale are kind of, like, sweet, and, you know, I did enjoy the film and laughed out loud a few times.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. That's one of the films I do want to try to hit for my 31 days this year.
Yeah. Horror comedies are anybody who can make a successful one, I've got a lot of respect for, because they're incredibly difficult to sort of walk the line and kind of like not get whiplash from the tone. So
yeah, you need a level of like self awareness to include in it. It's, you know, movies like the later entries in Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street. They try to kind of hit that, because, you know, I think after you've had so many entries in a film series, that's pretty much the only way you can go.
Right. You got to change it up a little bit, and adding more humor just seems like an easy way to dive headfirst into more entertaining territory.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it's Hatchet was a lot of fun. I was really surprised. To be honest, I'm not really sure what made me sit down to watch it, but, you know, I was it was a welcome first time watch, I'd say.
Yeah, I remember when that movie first came out. It was NC-17, right?
You know, I'm not sure. It is pretty gruesome, though.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was released only in AMC theaters. Like, they're the only chain that would release it.
That does sound familiar, actually.
Yeah, and I remember a lot of people talking about it at the time, and I can't understand why, you know, why I didn't check it out. But now they have a couple sequels. They have three Hatchets, right?
Well, apparently at the end of August, the director had a secret film.
Oh, that's right.
Victor Crowley.
Yeah.
Which I guess was technically the fourth one, but I'm not sure if it, not being called Hatchet, it, you know, I feel like it's probably like a prequel or something. Maybe something that's out of order chronologically.
This trend of sort of like titling your new sequel like just the name of the character, like, you know, Victor Crowley. I get maybe it started with Rambo, but you had like Logan came out earlier this year, you know, and
well, I mean, you got like Jason Goes to Hell or like the Chucky films.
Well, even this month in theaters, you've got Jigsaw coming out.
Pass.
Instead of Saw 37, it's just Jigsaw.
Yeah, I'm definitely not going to watch that.
Yeah. So, but Hacksaw, damn it, Hatchet is a recommendation, right?
Oh, yeah, it's a lot of fun. I mean, don't expect too much out of it, because, you know, it's, if you're any sort of horror fan who watches, like, slasher films, you're not going to see anything different. But, you know, it's fun for, like, you know, short runtime. It's probably between 80 and 90 minutes, but it's a good time.
I remember the trailer sort of reminding me of, like, My Bloody Valentine. Is there any kind of that vibe going on?
You know, I've never seen either of those films, so.
Mm. Cool. All right. You want to dive into Tale of Two Sisters?
Sure, absolutely. I've been waiting for this.
All right, well, why don't you set us up this time and let us know in general what the movie's about.
Okay, well, Tale of Two Sisters, as I mentioned earlier, is a movie from 2003. Basically, the plot of the film is a young girl who has been hospitalized for an undisclosed reason returns home with her younger sister and her father to their home, which is like this beautiful, gothic, very creepy-style house that's kind of like adorned with you know, like foliage and stuff. It's a very autumn looking and also kind of like modern gothic looking building. Joining them is their new stepmother, the young girl, her name is Sumi, and her younger sister Suyeon, they seem to resent a bit, because apparently their mother, who was dying of an illness, committed suicide in the home, presumably because the father was having an affair with their stepmother, named Yunji, played by Yum Jung-ah. Now, while the sisters are in this house, they start experiencing some supernatural things, as well as some surprisingly cruel stuff from their stepmother. And the film pulls back layers to unveil something tragic happening in the family's past.
There you go. That was a great description, but I want to let people know that if they haven't seen this movie, that it is incredibly important they not listen to this podcast before they see it.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think feel that a lot of the stuff that we're going to discuss, it's going to be me gushing and me pointing out stuff that are very spoilery.
Yeah, we're going to spoil the shit out of this. So, and for real, like, this is one of those movies, and, like, I don't want to reveal too much as I'm warning you right now, but if, you know, if you've ever had something spoiled for you and then you didn't get the enjoyment out of the film that you wanted, you know, please make sure you go watch this movie. And here's how you can watch it. It is available on DVD. If you have the capability of watching an import Blu-ray, there's an import Blu-ray, but it's not a U.S. release. So you can get the DVD from Amazon. Right now they have it around $10. It's between $10 and $11. So you can get it from Amazon.
Yeah, the import Blu-ray, I do want to mention, there's a Korean release. Is that the one you're referring to?
You know, I'm not sure. Amazon has the import Blu-ray on their site, and it, like, I forget the price. It was fairly reasonable for a Blu-ray, but it was not a Region 1.
Region A, you mean?
Yeah, whatever.
Oh, okay. I'm pretty – well, I mean, there are you know, any number of like Korean websites that you could actually order the disc from. It tends to be pretty – Korean films tend to be pretty English-friendly, their releases. So they are also Region A in terms of Blu-ray. So if you were willing to import one, it's a gorgeous-looking film that will play in most unmodified American players.
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, the other option for people right now, Amazon Video does not have it available to stream. However, Amazon offers a free 7-day trial to their channel for Shudder. And I watched the film on Shudder. And I highly recommend trying Shudder if you're a horror fan, or even just if you want to watch horror movies this month. Currently, you can get a free 7-day trial through Amazon. After your 7-day trial, it's only $3.99 a month if you sign up for the year up front, or it's $4.99 a month if you want to keep it month to month. So it's cheap, and they have a great selection of horror movies. Shudder offers a student discount also. So if you sign up under their student discount rate, they have 20% off if you do it for the whole year, or 30% off. I'm sorry, I got that backwards. 20% off if you do it monthly, 30% off if you sign up for the year in advance. So you can pay as little, you know, if you're a student and you're currently enrolled in college, you can get 30% off for a year at $3.99 a month. So you're basically, it's $3 a month, which is crazy good because their selection's great. And it's curated by people who absolutely love horror films. And you can really tell that the people who run it and acquire content for it love horror movies. And it's sort of like, and I've only had the chance to kind of go through it a couple of times. The only movie I've watched through Shudder is this one. But you can cross-reference things by not just by like subgenre of horror, but like by sort of like monster. So like there's zombie versus vampire versus slasher, you know. So it's pretty cool. So I would recommend checking that out and watching this movie for free. But if you want to get the DVD or import the Blu-ray, certainly those are great options too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Shudder is not a sponsor of our show, by the way. That's just me.
If you guys want to, if you guys are listening, you're open.
Well, you should contact them and let them know that you write for Film Smash and that we just pimped them out on our podcast. Maybe they'll send you some swag we can give away for Halloween.
Okay, so, you know that I'm a big fan of the film. Now, you mentioned earlier that you hadn't, that you had seen it, but it felt pretty fresh because you didn't recognize, since you didn't recall much of it during your viewing. So what was your first reaction to the film?
Well, it felt incredibly fresh. To be honest, like I would say up until the first turn, like twist, turn, revelation, whatever you want to call it. I was not sure that I had ever seen it, but I was sure that I had ahead of time. So it's really good. Deliberately paced psychological horror slash thriller. You know, it's moody, it's spooky. So I mean, it's all the types of things that I appreciate in a film. It's got great craft, the cinematography, the costumes, the lighting, the acting is quite good as well. So I was in. I would understand somebody watching it for the first time. It does move slowly, especially for the first, almost an hour, right?
You're talking about before the reveal?
Yeah.
I want to say in my mind it was probably closer to 50 minutes, but close to an hour.
Yeah,
yes.
45 minutes to an hour. The first 45 minutes to an hour, like, I can get, you know, certain people getting a little antsy and waiting for something to happen. But I certainly was into it, and I watched it with the girlfriend, and she was into it as well. And she was, you know, we were sort of huddled under a blanket, and she was kind of like, you know, tensing up in the right places. And so it kind of worked on her. The last, you know, I'm sure we're going to go through and talk about it sort of. This is the kind of movie I think we should go through from beginning to end and kind of like point out things.
Okay.
But like the last, I guess it's 30 to 40 minutes of this movie, it's a real mindfuck. I mean, if you don't pick up the clues, you'll have no idea what the hell is going on in the last act of this movie.
Yeah, one of the things I really love about watching this film annually is that every viewing, I always find additional clues to the revelation.
Yeah,
before, or little pieces that the director is like meticulously placed or shot or that kind of like enriched the movie for me even further.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of, I wouldn't say misdirection, but there's like, he really plays a lot of things vague early in the film. And when you gave it away in your description of the film, you know, I personally was not 100% sure who came home from the mental hospital. It could have been any one of the three women in the house up until a certain point, because they keep going back and forth. And I'll give you an example. For me, like, I picked up on the costuming immediately, which seemed like a red herring, but like,
the colorful.
Yeah. Well, like Soo-young is the younger sister, and she's quieter and has short hair. Now, the girl who's in the opening scene of the movie takes place in the institution, and a doctor is asking a girl questions. You can't see the girl's face. Her hair is over her face, so you don't know who it is. Now, the older sister, Soo-mi, has longer hair, but to be honest, I didn't think that necessarily meant anything, because, you know, somebody comes home from a mental institution getting a haircut and sort of changing, you know, their physical appearance might be something that you would do to sort of brighten their mood. I don't know. So I didn't necessarily take that as being like a definitive proof that Soo-young was not the person there and that Soo-mi was. But I sort of like picked up on their costuming immediately, because Soo-mi, not only is she more outspoken personality wise, but she wears brighter colors. She has like a red hat and sweater on in the opening of the film, whereas Soo-young has more earth tones and darker colors. And there's that, you know, really, you know, nice scene where they go to the wharf and sit with their legs in the water, and Soo-young kind of stares blankly into the depths of the murky water the whole time, whereas Soo-mi sort of is enjoying the sunlight. She doesn't necessarily seem like someone who's depressed or was just institutionalized. So there are little clues like that the whole time that are sort of like taking you in one direction that may not necessarily be the right direction. So like, I don't know. Yeah, there's a lot of doubling in the film.
That's definitely present. That's one example of, I guess maybe leading. I mean, that's probably one of the more obvious ones, the overt ones, but like the director Kim Ji-won, he definitely, likes to tease the audience.
Right. But there's the whole thing with the pills too. Like, you know, the stepmother is the one who takes the medication, right? So like, is the stepmother the one who came from the institution? So like, the whole time I'm sort of like second guessing what I know about the film, and even when they sort of give you a clue that seems like it's a confirmation of which female character was in the institution, I was still never quite sure. And that's something that like I really thought that was cool. Like, I appreciated that. Like, it continually kept me guessing, and kept me on not necessarily the edge of my seat as far as like the thriller horror aspects, but sort of perked up and being more attentive to see if I could figure it out too. It was engaging me in that way, not just on a visceral level.
Well, I think like there's a number of scenes. I think I mean, you mentioned earlier that the film does move a bit slowly. I think like with different writing, I think the film itself it does run slow, but I think it could be a very compelling, just straight up family drama. You throw in like this thriller aspect and like the possibility of the supernatural into it, and like the movie kind of evolves and, you know, adds another dimension to kind of like this intriguing family drama.
Yeah, well, I mean, personally, like the supernatural aspects of the film don't even creep into the picture until midway through, really. There's a little bit that, well, I guess it's that first night, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that first night.
It does take up a chunk of time, though, before that happens, though.
Yeah. So the first night, it's the younger sister, Soo Yun, you don't know whether it's a nightmare or whether it's really happening, but she imagines that someone's trying to get in her room and there's, like, fingers coming around her door. And then she goes to sleep in the bed with Sumi instead, right?
Yes.
So that definitely has a supernatural tinge to it, but it also feels like it could be more of a nightmare scenario as opposed to actually like a spectral occurrence.
Sure. I mean, that's easy to believe considering her demeanor. The actress who plays her name is Moon Kyung-yong. I think this movie was probably one of her big breaks. Though obviously the older sister, this was her big break, absolutely.
And that's Lim Seo Jung.
Im Soo Jung. Okay. So I mean, depending on how they romanticize it, I guess it could be written a couple different ways. So now, like, I think. Obviously, she kind of dominates the film along with their stepmother, who's played by Yum Jong Ah. Those two are kind of like a tour de force, especially with their dueling battle of wills. I guess that you see on display in the film.
Absolutely, and it's funny because in large stretches of the film, they will dominate a number of scenes, and the other character will sort of disappear, which is something that. You know, that sort of adds to the idea that there's really only one character there, but,
the scenes when the two are together though, there's a prevailing sense of tension, like whenever they're in the same room together.
Yeah.
That, you know, that really transitions into like a pretty like brutal explosion towards the end of the film. Which, I mean, mean, you know, considering Revelation is a film, you can take it any way you want. But it's a surprising, like explosion of violence, kind of similar to the way, like, if you say, maybe not quite like, say, Drive, like the elevator scene in Drive, but, like, it's...
Oh, no. Yeah, I know what you mean, though. Yeah.
But like, it comes out of nowhere because the film presents itself in one way before it turns into, like, some, you know, pretty affecting physical acting.
Yeah. I was really interested in the idea of, like the doubling early in the picture, which sort of feels a little bit like deja vu in certain scenes. Like the father's undergarments, and then, you know, when she comes into the house initially, she's got it's like a book, a journal, and a pen, and she goes to put them away, and there's like an identical book, journal, and pen in her drawer, which seems very odd, and it strikes her as odd at the time. And so there's a lot of little things like that that's sort of like, they don't seem supernatural, they just seem strange, you don't know what to think of them.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, that the house has a history, but during those moments, like at the beginning of the film, you don't necessarily know if the family has history or if it's something that, you know, maybe it's a new house. I mean, there's so many horror films where moving to a new house is kind of like the setup for the film.
Sure, absolutely.
But you know, as it turns out, the house is very closely tied to their history. And I mean, do you just want to like mention like what the spoiler is?
Oh yeah, I mean, you can
reveal big reveal.
Go yeah. for it. Yeah, people were warned, Cesar.
I'm asking you. Yeah.
I think we overwarned them actually. So
yeah, you think so? Okay. I was waiting for you.
Oh, I thought you were asking me because
I was asking you,
because you were about to reveal it.
No. Go ahead.
No, well, this, I mean, believe me, this movie's got more endings than Return of the King. So I mean, the first big reveal is that Soo Young is dead. That she's not there at all. So
okay.
At that point, I think as a first-time viewer, you're not thinking that she's a projection. I think you're thinking that she's a ghost.
Yes. The Korean release of the movie has a number of deleted scenes, which include director commentary. So I watched those to kind of help prepare for this as well.
Okay.
In the deleted scenes, the director does mention that Soo Young is a ghost. Though it could be taken that she is a projection, the director was writing off the assumption that during the production of the film that she is a ghost in this house.
Yeah, well, I think that we'll get to the dinner scene, I guess, at some point. But I think there's definitely evidence that the house is actually haunted and it's not just in her mind.
Yes.
But yeah, so like that's the first big reveal. So, like, and that's, yeah, 50 minutes to an hour into the film. You know, there's an argument between the father and Sumi, it's the second time they have a conversation where he tries to find out what's wrong with her and to get her to talk to him in some way and express what she's feeling. And in the first scene, that's kind of like the first mention of the wardrobe. But they kind of pass over it fairly quickly, right? Like,
yes.
We know the wardrobe's kind of like it's photographed, like it's kind of spooky and dark, and we see Soo Young's reaction to the wardrobe, where she's certainly, maybe afraid's the wrong term, but she, you know, she's nervous around it.
Yeah, wary of it. Yes.
Yeah. And so when the father approaches Sumi and she says, you know, you need to get the wardrobe out of Soo Young's bedroom. And he says something to, I'm not quoting him directly, but something to the effect of, you know, we agreed not to talk about that, didn't we? And then the conversation just keeps going. So like it's a point that I think the savvy viewer will pick up on right away, like, oh, the wardrobe is important. But the film continues to move beyond that. So when they have their big confrontation, and she talks about how that woman, meaning the stepmother, kind of ruined everything, and it's his fault, and how she keeps terrorizing Soo Young, he comes out and says that Soo Young is dead. And that's your big Sixth Sense moment in the film.
Yes.
and I guess after that, there's just like you mentioned earlier when you described the film, there's sort of a peeling of layers. So, like, we think the reality is that she's there with the father and the stepmother, and when we find out that the sister is dead, then we think that the sister is perhaps a ghost. Further down the line, we discover that really it's just Sumi and her father in the house, and that the stepmother is not there at all, and that Sumi is actually playing the character of the stepmother. And I'm still not 100% sure whether she's playing the character of the stepmother at, like, the dinner or at other parts of the house with the father.
Well, I think anytime you see Eunsu, who's the stepmother, you can assume that she's also participating in those moments as well. Like, I mean, you're talking about, like, the very memorable dinner scene. You know, she's telling a story as her father's wife. Or the way she interprets her father's wife.
Right.
And it's making everyone very uncomfortable. She's telling, like, you know, you could take it a couple different ways, but she's telling a story involving her brother, her, in quotation marks, I'm making air quotation marks as I say brother.
Yeah.
Who's been invited to dinner with them. About a memory that he does not recall.
Now, is he supposed to be the mother's brother or the stepmother's brother?
He's supposed to be Eunju's brother and his wife. So Eunju is the stepmother.
Right.
But then, you know, of course, as the film reveals, like, she's not there, so maybe she's not actually the stepmother at all.
Right.
She's
just the woman who gets blamed for breaking up the marriage and for the death. And
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, later... is revealed that, like, she really is a stone cold bitch who let the kid die.
A real bitch.
Yeah. So, which is funny because there's more misdirection when you figure out all this is going on, and she goes to, like, the institution with Sumi, and she acts, like, really concerned and really loving towards her. But then when you get to the flashback of what quote unquote actually happened, like, she really is an evil bitch.
It's a really chilling moment when she lets someone die out of spite. Her words, you're going to regret this moment, are so, like, cold-blooded.
Well, is it clear to you, I'll throw this out as a question that you can expand on, does she really know that both the mother and the child are in the wardrobe and the child is dying, or does she possibly think that it's just the mother?
Well, I'm pretty sure. Well, I think there's nothing to kind of argue against it. She hears Soo Young, I think. I think the voice between, like, an older woman and a younger girl would be pretty
distinctive. Yeah. It also takes place in Soo Young's bedroom, so that makes sense that she would assume it was the child.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. But at that point, no one's like, where's the mother?
I think there's, you know, you can look at it as the mother is having suffered through an illness. There's a deleted, there's a number of deleted scenes from what I viewed earlier, where there was originally also a subplot of the suicide was not only the hanging, but also in conjunction with poison.
Pills? Okay, because she has a bottle of pills.
Yes.
So I think...
Like, most of that was removed from the theatrical version of the film, and because I think the director said it made stuff a little bit too complex. But there were a couple of pretty chilling scenes involving that poison subplot in the deleted scenes. Like, for instance...
That's interesting.
Yeah. Like, for instance, Sue Mi, like, there's a moment early on in the film where they go to, like, the storage house, and she and her sister are taking stuff from a storage house of, like, mementos of their mother. And she finds a bottle of poison inside the storehouse with her mother's things. So one of the things she takes back in the deleted scene, of course, is, you know, not just pictures and, like, boxes and trinkets and stuff, but she also takes back a portion of this poison with her. A subsequent deleted scene later on also has her, after, like, the torture of Su-yeon being put into wardrobe, she attempts a type of revenge, which is she douses the pills that the stepmother is taking in the poison, and before replacing them back into, like, the medicine cabinet, which, you know, is very creepy considering what we know now at the end of the film that she's playing both.
Right.
So you could look at that as a manifestation of her guilt and, like, you know, self-loathing, you know, and, you know, survivor's remorse, of course.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, you mentioned the pictures. This is the third movie in a row that we've done where, like, pictures have been, like, a very important point in the film. You know, like, or important to a character. You know, in Le Cercle Rouge, you know, Corey's photos of his ex, you know, representing, you know, the past that he's sort of given up and moved on through. And in Blade Runner, of course, you know, the replicant's photos and Deckard's photos and Rachel's photo are all, you know, integral to kind of, like, deciphering what's happening in that film. And then, of course, in this one, the photos are actually a big revelation because we don't know what relationship the stepmother had to the family until those photos surface.
Yes.
And it's... Sumi seems to be shocked and surprised when she sees the photographs that have the stepmother in them also.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think she's, you know, the progression of the like the photographs as it starts. I mean, she finds a stack of pictures. She begins flipping through them, and it's almost like a very tender moment of, you know, happier times. But then, you know, she sees a family portrait of her. Not portrait, but like a family shot of her parents and her sister on a couch. The next picture after that, it's a similar picture, but it has the stepmother slowly integrating herself into the majority of the pictures.
Right, and the mother has more of like a blankish stare.
Yes. Now, one of my favorite clues in the film as to like the revelations is that moment when she's flipping through the pictures, Sumi flipping through the pictures, it's actually mirrored pace-wise when the stepmother finds those pictures with her face scratched out.
Oh, yeah, nice.
So that's one of, like, the great clues of the film and one of the moments that I really adore about the movie, those weird little touches, so.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, this movie is full of them, so that's...
Well, another one that I'm a big fan of is, of course, Su-yeon. She dies by being crushed by a wardrobe.
Yeah, tragic, horrible.
Yeah, she's crushed and asphyxiated, so she suffocates to death underneath it. During the dinner scene, when Yunju's wife begins a convulsive seizure, her body mimics Su-yeon's body underneath the wardrobe, which isn't something you will ever catch, like, the first time you're watching it, necessarily. Because, you know, during the seizure, you know, she begins clutching her throat as if she's unable to breathe.
Right.
So I think that's a very great moment that's telegraphed in there.
Yeah, now, that scene in particular, though, I mean, that's actually a really, really great scene. And it sort of comes out of the blue, so, like, it's sort of shocking, and, like, you're stunned watching that scene, I think. But here's my question for you. Does that actually happen?
I believe so.
Okay. Well, there are a couple of very odd things about that scene that I guess I want to point out. When we see the brother and his wife driving to the home before dinner, and it's just a point of view shot of the road, and it's sort of like a winding, like, you know, like through a forest or something like that. There's like a blue tent in the middle of the road that they kind of like drive right. Like, they don't go through it, but like they drive right next to it. But it's like in the middle of the road. Did you catch that?
Yeah.
Okay. Like,
it's just a partition for, you know, I mean, it wasn't a forest that they're in. It's like a more mountainous area.
Yeah.
Korea is very mountainous. Like hiking is one of the big things for people to do there. It's that more than likely is a broken off piece of the road that may have come apart and resulted in a landslide or rock slide or what have you. So it's just partitioned off so people will separate until it can be repaired.
Okay.
So that's actually not uncommon.
Yeah. Well, the seizure itself is incredibly upsetting.
Yeah, it really is.
But like the thing that struck me like is that like they go and get pills for the wife. And they give her pills, which like because you're you know, as the viewer, you have no idea what kind of pills they're giving her. Like, I almost thought that maybe Sumi was playing that character too.
Well, but the pills that they give her are a prescription bottle, so I think it's safe to assume. Well, the husband wouldn't allow just any pill to go into her, but it's safe to assume that maybe she had a history of seizures, and you know, basically the house kind of brought it out into her.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that definitely, you know, adds to the supernatural aspect of it.
Yeah, considering what she sees a woman underneath the sink.
Yeah,
which is very creepy.
Well, she doesn't see that until after the seizure or during the seizure.
Well, we don't know that. She sees it in that moment, but she doesn't mention it until the car ride home in a brief interlude with her and her husband.
Sound design for this film is really, really good.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of the soundtrack, the score in particular.
Well, aside from the score, like, there's all kinds of like weird sounds on the soundtrack that sort of,
the Foley is really good in the movie.
Well, but like there's almost like a mechanical humming in some scenes, and in other scenes there's like a almost like a radio frequency sound. And so like I just really enjoyed kind of like picking up on some of that stuff.
Yeah, there's a moment early on in the film where the stepmother, she is downstairs and there's a television on, but there's nothing on it. It's nothing but static.
Right. And Ode to Poltergeist.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. There's a bunch of like, I can't remember specifically. There's a scene, I think, before the stepmother goes downstairs and catches Sumi with her father. So before the scene with the television, she sits up in her bed. So she's got her feet on the floor. She's sitting on the bed, but she's upright.
Yes.
And there's an unsettling sound effect, which sounds almost exactly like the hum from the monolith in 2001. So I took that as sort of like an homage to that, like sort of like taking that from that. And there were a couple other things like the poltergeist thing. And then of course, like the black and white freeze frame towards the end of the film really struck me as like a 400 blows kind of moment.
Yeah.
So like, well, Kim Ji-woon certainly is steeped in film noir and understands, you know, his influences.
I've been talking about the deleted scenes. There was also another subplot that exists. You see a tidbit of it at very on in the film when they first arrive at the home. But the father, Mu-hyun, he is there with his daughter, but he is also recording. Like, he has video cameras set up.
Oh, yeah?
It's not like, Well, it's like at the beginning of the film, you see him playing with a camcorder, and you assume it's just him kind of fiddling with it, you know, because of whatever memories or sentimentality. But like apparently, while he's there with his daughter, like you see, like that scene in particular, where you see her sitting on the side of the bed. There's a deleted scene where it was supposed to be at the very end of the film, where like the physician from the beginning of the film, who's asking Sumi questions, as well as another man who you find out later on is a some kind of expert in like unexplained phenomena, or yeah. You know. He is there to give a second opinion to the doctor at the beginning of the film.
Okay.
But they're watching a video of, it's the bedroom where the father and Sumi are in bed. Of course, in the film, the father gets up because it's very uncomfortable to be sleeping in the same bed as your daughter.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. But he is fully clothed, though, but he's spooning her, which is creepy.
Well, I think, yeah, it is. That's probably one of the reasons why this scene was taken out, because it goes on a little bit longer, but he doesn't do anything. So, I mean,
no, and I'm sure it's, you know, there's no scene that precedes it in the film. So I'm sure it's prompted by her wanting him to do that and maybe playing the part of the wife.
Yes.
But we don't see that. So we just see the two of them in bed together. But yeah, it's when the revelation comes that it's actually the daughter, like immediately I was like, hey, he was in like,
All right. So,
No.
The scene where he's recording. So there is no incest. The director makes it explicit. Yeah. Internationalism's, that's become like a big, that became a big talking point once when the film was originally released. But I don't believe it is. I mean, the father, he's so depressed, you know, like he's so dark the entire film. I mean, you can imagine he goes through a lot too.
Yeah.
But the deleted scene basically is like a stationary camera that's looking at their bed. That night you see him get up. He looks right at the camera and walks off. The scene you mentioned, where Eunju, the stepmother, sits up on the side of the bed. You also see Sumi get up in that moment. So that scene is recreated for this film that these two doctors are watching that was going to be at the end of the film.
Now, okay.
The first doctor, he mentions that, that, you know, like what he's seeing on the video doesn't fit with like what he studied and what he knows. Hence the second opinion. The paranormal like expert, he kind of says, you know, she looks like she has signs of like, you know, possession, like subtle signs of possession in her.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess you could also kind of like assume that, you know, this dissociative personality disorder, you know, would have very similar look to that, you know?
Absolutely. Well, one of the other things that, I guess should be a red flag for people if they're keen enough to pick it up throughout the film is that the father never addresses Soo-young ever.
Yes.
He does address the other two female characters, but he does not address Soo-young, at least not directly. So like early in the picture, there's a couple of scenes where the way it's shot, it almost looks like he could be addressing and looking at her, but he's really looking at Sumi.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So that, like, you know, like, that's one of those things where even if it's unconscious, even if you don't pick it up, like, I think it's incredibly well-crafted because you're going to feel it even if you can't articulate what it is.
Yeah, you know, and you know, subsequent viewings. I mean, people need to watch this movie and multiple times.
Yeah. Once the reveal happens, I love the scene where Yeonju, the stepmother, sort of like tortures Soo-young by putting her in the wardrobe,
that's so unsettling.
And she demands to have an apology and stuff like that, but like. The colors in that scene, you know, like the red and the lighting is like coming up from the floor so that there's shadows like over her face. So her eyes look black as night. So she looks almost like she looks almost dead-eyed in that. And she's really good. The actress is incredibly good in the movie. She goes from being peppy and manic to being sort of like scary, angry, demonic. She's got a whole like she's really covering the range of everything. So it's a great role for her.
Yeah, she's excellent. Absolutely.
And the young girl who plays Sumi is also quite good.
She's definitely. I think she's definitely the most memorable. But like her, like I think at that age, like her depth is like amazing. I thought.
Yeah, it's tough. I guess the guy who plays the father doesn't have a lot. He sort of like walks around depressed and stunned and quiet most of the film. But the one scene where he does reveal that that the younger daughter is dead, he's also quite good in that scene too.
Yeah. The director mentioned that like. He had to cut what he felt was that actor, Kim Kap-soo, the father. He had to cut what he felt was the actor's best scene in the movie because of blow. So he said it killed him to do it, but it was too bad because he's quite good in a number of other films I've seen him in. So
yeah, yes, I mean Ultimately, this is a horrible, tragic heartbreaker of a movie. but it should it should creep you the fuck out too.
I love it though. I think it elicits feelings and reactions that I wish most movies. I wish most more movies tried to. Give you a reaction.
Yeah.
A real reaction, not something superficial.
Was there any criticism of this film at the time that you recall that because this was 4 years after The Sixth Sense, so it was just another one in a long line of movies trying to like capture that whole Twilight Zone twist M. Night Shyamalan thing?
No, I mean, if there was criticism, it probably wouldn't really have been in the United States. In Korea, at least, there wasn't because... homegrown films tend to kind of dominate. Now, The Sixth Sense was like kind of a worldwide hit, but definitely homegrown stuff, especially horror films, tend to kind of rule the roost.
Yeah.
So The Sixth Sense probably isn't as widely seen internationally as as it is in the United States.
Yeah. Ji-Woon Kim also directed. One of the three extreme movies, right?
He directed
the second one.
One entry in it because those are omnibus anthology pictures.
Okay, all right. And he also did I Saw the Devil, The Good, the Bad, and the Weird.
Bittersweet Life, which is an amazing movie too.
Really? Okay. And he's currently working on a live action adaptation of the popular anime series Jinro, right?
Which I'm unsure about. If he wasn't attached to it, I'd be like, no dice. But, what a lot of people are familiar with Jinro, which is an animated film from Mamoru Oshii, but a lot of people are less aware that it's also part of a live-action series of films directed by Mamoru Oshii as well, which are very odd. Jinro is probably the most straightforward of all of them, though, honestly.
Okay. Well, this movie, like I said, is a mind trip. It's a it'll really get you, I think, for first time viewer. Then I watched it a second time the night after. So I watched this Saturday night with the girlfriend, and then after she went to bed Sunday night, I went ahead and rewatched it and took some notes and sort of like tried to really appreciate like. How he's able to sort of like, make this movie work. It was just as creepy the second time, even though I was taking notes and like starting and stopping it. Like it's the major moments in this film really, really worked. So if for any reason you listen to this without having seen the movie, I still suggest watching the damn thing, but
yeah, right. Run out and watch it.
Or maybe just, you know, open up your browser and watch it. Or go to your TV and watch it. You don't have to go out of your house. Because I don't think anybody's playing it in the movie theaters right now.
No.
Now, this is also based on a Korean folktale. Is there, and it's been adapted into a movie many, many times. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm aware that it is, and I've heard that it's been adapted multiple times. I don't believe I've seen any other version of it, though, aside from this. From what I understand, from what I've read about the story, is that it's only very loosely influenced by it. It's a pretty disturbing, story, I guess. You know, not a lot of happy stuff happening at all.
Yeah, well, that's it works perfectly. But yeah, really, really great film. I'm glad you chose this one for this episode. So, as the start of our October Horror Fest. I don't know if you saw, but I put a poll up on the Celluloid Jelly forum in Facebook to get some suggestions for our next movie. What did you vote for?
The Thing.
Okay, all right. I'm okay with that. We can do The Thing next week.
Well, I voted for The Thing. Let's see what everyone else does.
Well, that was by far the most popular. A second was A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Well, I want to vote for something else then.
I
don't go with the flow.
I think Invasion of the Body Snatchers had one vote, and
you know, I don't think I've seen that in like decades.
Yeah, I love that movie. The original black and white one. The one with Donald Sutherland I've never seen, actually. And that's like one of the great moments in Donald Sutherland's career is that face he makes when he's pointing at the end of the film, I guess.
Very, very online meme-worthy.
Yes, and I still have never seen that version of it. It's got to be better than the Nicole Kidman, Daniel Craig version.
Oh, yeah, that movie's pretty bad.
Yeah, well, that was... I remember... I can't remember who actually directed it,
Baltimore.
But yeah, they shot action scenes and stuff in Baltimore. And my understanding is that the Wachowskis came in and did stunt work and action photography for them.
Yeah, there's a car chase that goes through like the city, and that has earmarks of Wachowski.
Yeah.
You know, visual.
Cool. Do you have anything else on A Tale of Two Sisters?
Not really. To be honest, this discussion kind of makes me want to rewatch it again, maybe with commentary, though, this time.
Yeah, nice. Oof, I don't know if you can hear this. My stomach is growling. I have not had breakfast yet.
Oh, yeah? I'm pretty hungry, too.
Yeah. Well, all right, cool. Well, are we decided on The Thing for next time?
I don't know. Are we letting people vote? Is that pretty much a lock?
That was a few days ago, though. Yeah, like The Thing is way, way ahead of everything else.
Okay, that's cool.
I mean, if they, you know, we've got a couple more episodes in October, so if we want to do two more horror movies, we can.
Okay, cool.
So, but we'll do The Thing. How's that?
Yeah, that's fine.
I own it on Blu-ray, so that makes it easy for me.
Did you want to pick a horror movie for yourself too? Since I had Tale of Two Sisters.
I'm happy doing The Thing for now. We can always, we'll see how we feel next week. That's fine.
Okay.
I don't want to get too ahead of myself.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, definitely see A Tale of Two Sisters, or definitely rewatch A Tale of Two Sisters, and
yes.
Watch The Thing so you can listen to our podcast next week. There's probably not that many of you who haven't seen John Carpenter's The Thing, but you know, go ahead and rewatch it so we can talk about it. And I guess, where can people find you on the internet, Cesar?
Well, you can find my news and reviews at filmsmash.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Junior Beho.
Okay.
And where can people find you, CJ?
Of course, you can find me right here at Celluloid Jelly and at Twitter, on Twitter, at Setting the Frame.
Celluloid Jelly was recorded using Google Hangouts, mixed using Apple's GarageBand software, and hosted by Podbean. For any inquiries related to Celluloid Jelly, please email settingtheframe@gmail.com.